I'm told that I didn't speak loud enough last time. Duh. What I'd like for us to think about in the next 45 minutes is how God acts in changing the world and changing us. This way that God acts is the same way he acts in redemption as he acts in maturing the creation and maturing us. And the Bible reveals it to us right at the beginning. But it's two things that we don't find chapters on in our confessions of faith. You know, there's a lot of things the Bible talks about that aren't in the confession of faith. Like it talks about hair. In fact, there's all kinds of stuff in the Bible about hair. Ladies' hair, hair of Nazarites, hair on your arm, like when you get leprosy and the hair dies. All kinds of stuff. But in the Westminster Confession of Faith, there is no chapter of hair. Nor is there in the Belgic Confession concerning hair. Similarly, there is nothing in our confessions that talks about cutting apart and putting back together again. And there's really nothing in our confessions that talks broadly about death and resurrection or evening and morning. And yet, these are major themes in the Bible. They just don't happen to have been things that were controversial 350 years ago. But if we're going to understand the Bible in contrast to understanding certain theological debates that gave rise to our confessions, then we need to get a hold of some of these large things that the Bible talks about. And so I'd like for us to hear a familiar passage just for a few minutes. We won't read all of it, but just to get some things before us as we begin to think about these issues. And you know where this is. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and empty. And darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day. And the darkness he called night. And there was evening. And there was morning, a first day, or rather one day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. And let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament. And separated the waters that were below the firmament from the waters that were above the firmament. And it was established. And God called the firmament heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, a second day. And God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was established. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout forth grass, herbs yielding seed, and fruit trees, fruit bearing fruit after their kind, with seed in them on the land." And it was established. And the earth brought forth herbs, or grass, herbs yielding seed after their kind, and fruit trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a third day. And we could continue, but that's enough. What I want us to see here is that the first way that God acts on us and on the world is by cutting things apart and putting them back together again in new relationships, which are an improvement or a glorification of what was there before. Let's consider the fact that, well, God saw that the light was good. What else does God call good in Genesis 1? Nothing. Light is the only thing God calls good. At the end of, in the middle of the third day, God sees that the situation of land and sea is good. At the end of the third day, he sees that the grass on the earth, or grains, and the fruit trees on the earth is good. That means it's kind of like light. Now, if everything was good on the third day, why did God fool around with the fourth day? At the end of the fourth day, it says, God placed the sun and the moon, greater and lesser lights, in the firmament to govern the day and the light, and God saw that it was good. Oh, wait a minute. It was good the day before. So what's he doing changing it? If it's good, I mean, I was told, if it's not broke, don't fix it. All right? What's going on here? And then on the fifth day, it says, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and God blessed them. And God saw that it was good. Wait a minute. Each day is gooder than the day before. And God said the light is good, which means each day is lighter than the day before. Not lighter in the sense that we move from 60 to 100 to 120 watt bulb in the sky, but lighter in the more broad sense that each day is more glorious than the day before. It's glorious to have light, but it's more glorious to have the land and sea separated. And it's even more glorious when the land starts to grow things, green things on it. That makes it even more glorious. And it's more glorious when the firmament is blown out to form suns, moons, and stars to decorate the heavens at night. And it's even more glorious when the waters teem with fish and the air teems with birds. Each day is more glorious, is lighter than the day before, so that the world goes from glory to glory. And he does this initially by separating things and putting them into a new relationship with each other. Now, we see this not only in the world, but in human beings who are made of world. You are made of world. It says in chapter 2, verse 7, and Yahweh God formed man of dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Okay? You are made of dust. Y'all are just dirt balls here. Okay? Since you're baptized, it makes you holy land. You want to know where the holy land is? Look around. You're made of dirt. You have plants growing on you. Don't you? And all those laws of leprosy that talk about how if you get a white spot here and the hair turns brown and dies, you're unclean. That's because you're made of earth. And it's a parallel. You remember the book of Job? When the meteorites fall from the sky and there are open craters all over the land, what happens to Job's body? There are open craters and sores all over him as well, because he's the king and the king is tied to the land. These parallels exist, and they are the reason why some of the symbolic stuff that's in the law is there. Rivers flow out of the Garden of Eden. Man is made of earth. Jesus says, out of your innermost part flows rivers of living water. Although under sin, what flows out of us in the book of Leviticus are defiling issues. But that's because we're made of earth and we're like the garden. Good water comes out or bad water comes out. Okay, I'm not going to talk about that. But that's these parallels. Man is made of world. He's made of world stuff on the sixth day. We have all the stuff that God has done so far in us. But then Yahweh God says, it's not good for the man to be alone. I'll make a helper fit for him. So, out of the ground Yahweh God formed every beast of the field, bird of the sky, and brought them to the man. Whatever the man called a living creature, that was his name. Man gave names to all the cattle, birds of the sky. God gave names to things in Genesis 1. He called the gathering of the waters seas. Now man, the image of God, gives names. For Adam was not found a helper suitable for him. You know, I used to think that what that meant was there's two of every animal and there's just one of Adam, and what he needed was a wife. In the sense of, you know, a sexual partner, somebody to have children with. But that's not what this is talking about. It means a liturgical partner, somebody to respond in the liturgy with Adam. This is the garden. And no animals can talk back. Only women can talk back, excuse me. No. I hope we can get to this, but because the Bible is full of saying things twice. The Psalms, everything is said twice. The second time is always an expansion of some sort on the first thing that's said. Okay? And this is in the garden where the trees are, and Adam needs somebody to talk in response. In your worship service, don't you have this? The minister says something, the congregation says it back. You read Psalms responsively. What did Adam say to Eve? He said, "We must not eat of that tree." And how did Eve respond? "Neither shall you touch it." Was she right? Of course. Paul says, "Touch not, taste not, handle not." Goes together. Leviticus 11, what you don't eat, you don't touch. Rather, what makes you symbolically dead if you eat it makes you symbolically dead if you touch it. Eve is doing just the right thing. She's mirroring back and extending the meaning of what Adam says. It's a liturgical dialogue, which is immediately corrupted by the serpent. But that's what God wants. He wants a liturgical partner, somebody that the pastor can say something to, and then the congregation can say, "Yep, you know what? That implies this. Why do the heathen rage? And the people imagine a vain thing. The kings of the earth take their stand. And the rulers conspire together. Against Yahweh. Against his Messiah. Saying, let us cast away their cords from us." Or whatever's next. Okay? Back and forth. The first statement. The next one that draws out some of the meaning. That's what we want here. Also a wife, also a mother, but the first thing is a liturgical dialogue partner. All right, it's not good. So, what's he going to do to make the woman? Okay, he cuts Adam in half, right? Pulls out a rib. Okay, and then he fashions her into a woman. And then he reunites them. This is bone of my bone. A man shall leave his father and shall cleave to his wife and become one flesh. Beginning of this story, Adam was one flesh. Then now there's another one. And now they're reunited. And Adam is glorified. How do we know that Adam was glorified? Ladies, the woman is the glory of the man, right? Of course. So, the woman is the glory of the man. Adam begins the course of glorification by God taking him apart, putting him back together in a new way. Now, this is how God does things in history. It's how he does things in our lives. Remember when you were a little boy or a little girl? Some of you still are. You had a birthday party. And you invited the girls as well as the boys to the birthday party. Then there comes a time when you don't invite the girls anymore. Because you don't want cooties. Or if you're girls, you don't invite the boys anymore. Boys and girls become two different kinds of things. Somewhere around the fifth grade. And then they have to overcome the distance. At some point, the boys start showing off around the girls. The girls start dressing in a certain way to try to attract the boys. So they have to become artists. And the art of wooing and overcoming that distance takes place. But you're not going to have that process of wooing and overcoming the distance between boys and girls unless there's a time when they're separate first. But it wasn't originally that way. Little kids are undifferentiated that way. God makes the world. This is how the world works. This is how human beings work. This is how life works. There's no point in pretending otherwise or trying to force it into some other kind of a mold. And God works history this way too. In Genesis chapter 17, God cut the human race in half by introducing the rite of circumcision. From that time on, there were Hebrews and Gentiles, Israelites and Gentiles, Jews and Gentiles. But Jesus, descendant of both Jew and Gentile, according to Matthew, with Ruth and Rahab in his line, Tamar, in his resurrection, Jew and Gentile are put back together again, and that's what the book of Romans is about. That's why Romans starts off to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Jew and Gentile. All the way into chapter 11, the byplay of Jew and Gentile. And then, because in the resurrection of Christ, that separation is reunified into something that's more glorious than was there before. Glorified in Christ. This is how God does things. You'll read this story again and again in the Bible. Of God separating. Sometimes it's sin that separates things. Sometimes it's just boys and girls growing apart so that they can come back together again later on in marriage. That's the first way in which we can see God acting in Genesis 1 and following. The second way is that God acts through taking things down and bringing them back up higher than they were before. And taking things down, imagine a check mark. You go down and you come up higher. And then God takes you down and you come up higher. That's what happened in Genesis 1. In between each day, there's an evening. Why is that? Why don't we just have one day and then another day and then another day and then another day? Why do we have to go down into darkness and then come up again with more goodness than before? Okay. Each day is gooder than the day before. Lighter than the day before. Light is good. Good is light. More glorious than the day before. But in between, it gets dark. Why? Why do it that way? Unless this is the way God does things. And he does it with us too. We're made of world. You are made of world, and you live on the same clock as the world. Right now, you're getting real sleepy. I should say that louder for those in the back and to wake everybody else up. Okay? About this time of day, when it starts to get dark out there, you start to get dark in here. And then, if you close your eyes, it gets dark. And you lie down in a bed, and you go into the same darkness as the world goes into. Now, what's weird about this is, you go to bed tired, and then when you wake up in the morning, you're not tired anymore. Or at least that used to be true for me. But remember back when you were a little kid, and you were so tired, you just fell asleep on the sofa, and you wake up the next morning in the bed because your folks took you in there, and you bounded out of bed, you know, and woke your folks up? What's going on there? Why don't you wake up as tired as when you went to sleep? You ever thought about that? Are you thinking now, how come I never thought about that? Well, that's what's going on in Genesis 1. Every day turns out to have more than the day before. And isn't it a strange thing that we, made of world, we get tired, and when we wake up from sleep, we are regenerated. That means we get new life. Don't be afraid of that word, regeneration. We use it in theology sometimes for a very special, particular thing. But in the Bible, it just means you get new life beyond what you had before. And then on the next day, you're going to do things that went beyond what you did today. A man was telling me today about painting a fence. He said he painted it on four successive Mondays. He painted a fourth of the fence. Then the next Monday, he did more and added another fourth of the fence. Okay? And then on the next Monday, he did another fourth. And the next Monday, he finish it up. Well, every Monday is getting more done. Until there comes a time in your life when it begins to change and go the other way, and you're being prepared for the final transformation, which we'll talk about, the big death and resurrection. But in our lives, every night is an evening that leads to a new morning. And you just say, I am so tired. I'm dead tired. Why do we say dead tired? Because it's kind of like death. Now, remember how God made Eve out of Adam? It said, Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. So Yahweh God said, Adam, stand still. This won't hurt a bit. And then he made Eve. That's not how he did he? Uh-uh. Why didn't he? Why didn't he do it that way? Because that's not how God acts. That's not how God does things. Now, we could pull the veil back and start talking about the Trinity and the three persons of the Trinity and how each person of the Trinity delights to humble himself in order to glorify the other two. And maybe this stepping back of the Son to glorify the Father and the Spirit, this stepping back of the Spirit in order to glorify the Father and the Son, that maybe this stepping back motion in the dance of the Trinity has something to do with the fact that in this world, God does things by stepping back and in moving forward more than was there before. I think that's why. But that's a little bit speculative, just a little bit. Unlike everything else I'm saying, that's a little bit speculative. Okay? No, God puts Adam into sleep, and not just ordinary sleep. I mean, let me tell you something. If you were asleep and I pulled a rib out of your side, you'd wake up. No, this isn't some ordinary sleep. This is a completely different word in Hebrew from the ordinary word for sleep. This is the word radam or tardema, which our Bible translates as deep sleep. Okay? It's not the word sleep modified by the word deep in Hebrew. It's deep sleep, one word. Or, I prefer, death sleep. This is what Jonah was in when he was inside the whale. It says he was in death sleep while he was in the whale, and he prayed while he was in a dream in death sleep. Jesus says that his time in the grave would be like Jonah in the whale. So that we begin to see that the idea of death that we think of as death and deep sleep and ordinary sleep, there's kind of a continuum here. The New Testament talks about saints who have fallen asleep. And we know what that means. But why doesn't it say they died? It says they fell asleep. And they're going to wake up with more energy. And when you get to be 90 years old, if you get that old, and you can't do much anymore, the next thing is you're going to fall asleep and you're going to wake up with more than you had before. That's the big step. Along the way, there are a lot of little steps. That's how God does things. Every new covenant that's made in the Bible is made this way. Okay? Before God makes the Noahic covenant, what does he do? Floods the world. Okay? Death and resurrection. Book of Deuteronomy. Moses says, I have to die in order for this covenant to come fully into effect. In the book of Numbers, God says, you blew it, Moses, and that's why you can't go into the land. But in Deuteronomy, we find something, an additional aspect to that, where we find out that the death of Moses is sort of like a sacrifice that opens the door into the promised land. And so the book, he makes the covenant. The book of Deuteronomy happens all on one day. The entire book happens on one day. On that one day, Moses makes the covenant, and then he dies in order to bring the covenant to pass so the people can cross the river and get out of the desert. Elijah makes a new covenant, or God makes a new covenant through Elijah. He calls him back out to Mount Sinai. He tells him something brand new and totally weird. But this new covenant is made right after Jezebel murders the 100 prophets that were in the cave. Remember, Obadiah tells Elijah, I've kept 100 prophets alive in the cave, hiding them from Jezebel. And then Jezebel kills them. And Elijah says, I am the only prophet left. They've killed all the rest. And God says, yeah, you're the only prophet left, but I've got 7,000 church members. You need to go form a theological seminary and raise up some pastors for that 7,000, which they do. They form the school of the prophets. But a new covenant is made. And God says, I'm going to do something new, Elijah. I want you to go and anoint Jehu to bring a new dynasty in northern Israel. Okay. I want you to go and anoint Elisha to take your place when you're gone. Well, okay. And then the weird thing. I want you to go and put the holy anointing oil on a Gentile king. You mean the same oil that we put on David and made him a messianic king? Anoint means Messiah. You want me to do that for Hazael of Syria? Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to start taking over the nations right now. Right now, this change in history. A new covenant that's going to start including the nations. After the exile, when God makes a restoration covenant, we see the vision of the dry bones in Ezekiel. A resurrection from the dead. Death and resurrection is how God does things. And what do we find in the book of Romans? It's the resurrection of Jesus that unites Jew and Gentile. In his death, the distinction between Jew and Gentile dies. And in his resurrection, they are reunited in a glorified form, in a new body, a new, more glorious people. This is how God deals with things. And story after story in the Bible is the story of death and resurrection. The story of Ruth loses her husband. Naomi, barren, lost. Then there's resurrection. How does it happen? Ruth goes to Boaz during the night when it's dark and it's dead. And then the next day, she's married to him. And then there's babies. David, driven out by Saul, adopted by Saul, married to Saul's daughter, adopted by Saul's son, who says, you will be king and not me. And then driven out into the wilderness. The wilderness, another place of death. And then resurrected to be king. Job, death and resurrection. The story of Israel, death and resurrection. Over and over and over. Daniel, every chapter, story in the book of Daniel is a story of death and resurrection. They fast from the good food, and they should starve. Instead, they're smarter than all the others. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm going to kill everybody who can't tell me about this dream. But then he spares them because they get the truth. In chapter 3, they throw the three men into the fiery furnace. When they come out, they're made rulers in Babylon, higher than they were before. In chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is driven down like an animal. When he comes up, he's a greater king than he was before. In chapter 6, Daniel is thrown into the lion's den. When he comes out, he's made a greater ruler than he was before. Every time. These are the stories. God is telling us something here in these stories that we hear, the same story over and over again. This is how God does things. This is how God improves us. He puts us through hard times. He puts us through dark nights of the soul. He brings difficulties into our life. There's lots of ways we experience death. Some of them are because of sin. Some of them are just aspects of life. But they all are supposed to change us if we have faith. If we don't respond in faith, they make us worse. Okay. That which doesn't kill us only makes us stronger. That's what Nietzsche said. Well, that's true if you are doing it by faith in Christ. Otherwise, God will put you through hard times and you'll lose your faith. That's what it says. Some of the seed fell on soil, sprang up with joy, but when the sun of furnace and affliction came, it withered and died and did not maintain faith. That's how God acts. Now, this... When did I start? I have another 15 minutes, is that right?
Yes.
I have another hour and 15 minutes, is that right? Look with me at Genesis chapter 15. Let's just take this passage here and briefly look at it. Let me show you how these things are put together. And then we could say a few things about some of the symbolic rituals in the Bible. I mean, what I've said so far, you know, I could go into a sermon now. I've already touched on it, you know. Your life, things you go through, why God does these things, how God wants to grow us through these tearing experiences that we have sometimes. You feel like you're torn apart inside. The Psalms talk about that. David talks about feeling torn apart inside. It's how God does things and how it's like darkness. But he looks for resurrection. He looks for reunification and healing. So we could preach on this and we could do pastoral work on this. But I don't want to do that. See, because my job is to try to help you understand some of the hard parts of the Bible. And so let's look at, see, this is a clue to understanding what's going on in the sacrificial system. Why those animals are killed, why they're cut into pieces, and then they're put into the fire, and they're reunited in the fire and glorified in the fire. That ritual is giving expression to the same things we've been looking at. And they really start here in Genesis chapter 15. And so let's hear this. What's happened here in Genesis is Abraham has come into the land, Abram as he is now, Big Daddy. He's come into the land and he's lived there for 3 years. And this is a really crummy, two-bit, worthless piece of real estate, this land of promise. It's not a land of milk and honey. That's for later on. That's 400 years away. Right now, this place doesn't work. The first thing that happened to Abram after he came into the land, there was this big famine. Some promised land. Big famine, and he has to go down to Egypt. It's kind of like death in Egypt, you know. Go down there. They attack your wife. But he comes up with great spoils, better than before. And then this land is so crummy that Abraham's men and Lot's men can't occupy the same territory. Now, I don't know how 600,000 men and their families are going to occupy this territory 400 years from now when two men and their families can't occupy it right now, but they can't. So Lot separates from Abram. He separates from Abram. And then God comes to him and promises him all these glorious things. Separation, glorification. Then in chapter 14, this wonderful land, five kings have a big war against four kings, all in the same territory. So they just ravaged through the whole land. They capture Lot. And Abraham goes and gets Lot back. So there's certain reunification going on here. And he takes his 318 fighting men. It says in chapter 14, verse 14, Abraham heard that his brother Lot had been taken captive. He took out his army. He mustered his trained men, all adopted sons, a whole bunch of them. No, it says 318. Why does it say 318? I have no idea. But it doesn't say a lot of men. It doesn't say around 300. It says 318, not 319, not 317, 318. I think I know why. I think this is the numerical value of the name of the commander of this army, whose name was Eleazar of Damascus. That's the traditional explanation, but I'm not sure that's right. It's not the triangular of anything, I can tell you that. Because if it was, I'd know. He gets Lot back. And now he's scared because he's gone after Chedorlaomer, the most toughest of the guys, and he's gotten snuck out at night. It says, during the night, he rescues Lot, and as the day comes up, now they're reunited, and Lot is returned, and the gifts are given back to Melchizedek, king of Salem, and everything is more glorious than it was before. But in chapter 15, now Abram's afraid. And after these things, the word of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision saying, don't be afraid, Abram. Why is he afraid? Because Chedorlaomer's mad at him. And he says, I'm a shield to you. Your reward will be very great. And Abram said, O Master Yahweh, what will you give me since I'm childless? And the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. Now this is an adopted son. All 318 were men adopted. They were adopted by a ritual called the circumcision of the ear, where their ear was bored. Now, this is a whole other thing, but I'm just telling you, there's a blood ritual connected with the ear that means you are now an adopted second-class son. And if I don't have a literal son, then the number one of these adopted sons, Eliezer of Damascus, will inherit. And Abram said, you've given me no seed, and one adopted into my house, that's what this means, an adopted son, is my heir. And then the word of the Lord came to him and said, this man will not be your heir, one who comes forth from your own body. And he says, took him outside and says, now look toward the heavens and evaluate the stars. It doesn't say count them up. It says evaluate them. If you are able to evaluate them, and he says, this is how your seed will be. Now, this has to do with the meaning of the stars, and that's a whole other topic too. But Abraham looks, he understands something about the constellations and other aspects of the sky which reveal somehow the Messiah. The wise men knew how to read this, and they knew when the Messiah was being born. And Abraham, who is not yet a Jew and is still a Gentile, he can also read this. Okay, he says, read the sky. You can't do this. I don't know how to read the sky. We've forgotten. We don't need to know. We've got the completed Bible. But before the Bible was completed among the Gentiles, the wise men could read the sky, and that's when they knew Jesus was going to be born. And Abram, as a Gentile at this phase in his life, before he's circumcised, he also reads the sky. And he believed in Yahweh, and Yahweh reckoned it to him as righteousness. Well, he was already a believer, he was already justified, but in some fuller sense, he's glorifying in his relationship with God. I'm going to leave this question to all the people who want to discuss justification and move on to the next verse. And God says, I have brought you out of the Ur, and I'm going to give you this land. And Abram says in verse 8, he says, Master Yahweh, how am I know I'm going to possess it? And I think we can unpack it and say, you know, this is a pretty crummy two-bit land. You keep telling me that this is a great land, it's going to be a great land, a land of promise, but so far it's not been cooperating. This has been a very uncooperative land. Every time I try to do something, some army comes through, or there's a famine, or the crops fail so bad that we have to separate from each other. And so God says to him, let me explain you something. Let me explain to you about tearing things apart and putting them back together again. Let me explain to you something about death and resurrection. And let me explain to you something about faith. So God says, bring me a 3-year-old female ox, heifer, and a 3-year-old female goat, and a 3-year-old male sheep, a ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Why 3 years old? Because that's how long he's been in the land. And this is going to have something to do with taking away the problems of the land symbolically. And Abram brought these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he didn't cut the birds. Birds of prey came down on the carcasses and Abram drove them away. This is symbolic, okay? These animals are going to be resurrected, but they can't be resurrected if the birds come down and eat them up, so he has to drive them away. Now, the sun was going down. A deep sleep, this is that death sleep stuff, the place where super dreams take place, real deep visions. And you could die or you could be resurrected. Death sleep fell upon Abram. Behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. Sun was going down. He goes into this death sleep situation. He gets a psychological darkness comes on him. And while he's there, God says to him in the dream that goes on in this visionary state, know for certain that your seed will be strangers in a land not theirs. They will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will judge the nation whom they serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. They're going to die. They're going to be enslaved for 400 years, but then they're going to come out with much wealth. You've already experienced this, Abram. You went down to Egypt. They attacked your wife, but I protected you, and you came out with wealth. Now it's going to happen to your whole nation that comes out of you. What you went through, now they'll all go through. I will judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you will go to your fathers in peace and be buried in a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here, because the liabilities of the Amorites have not yet filled up. Their sins are increasing the liabilities against them, but they're not filled up yet. And it came about when the sun is set. Now, this is interesting, isn't it? It said the sun was going down, deep sleep is on him, darkness comes upon him, and now the sun is completely set. We're weighed down into super darkness before the dawn. Death, evening before morning. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark. Have we gotten the point yet? Okay, the sun was going down, death sleep comes upon him, terror, great darkness is upon him. The sun had set, it's very dark. I hope that it's coming through, that it was dark. There appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch that passed between these pieces. Oh. On that day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, to the river of Egypt, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the Euphrates. Now, I'm just going to tell you, the first time God promised the land to him, he told him he would give him the Jordan River out to the Mediterranean. Now, after this death experience, a much greater and more glorious land is promised to him. So, there is progression going on here. And the progression doesn't have to do with sin and judgment for sin and resurrection. It has to do with God increasing Abram's capacity for life through these experiences. And he says, I'm going to give you a much bigger land than you had, or I'll give it to your descendants. Now, what is this business of cutting these animals in half and God walking in between them? Well, some people say that's God saying, may I be torn in half if I don't keep this covenant with Abram. And there might be something about that, but there's nothing to substantiate that in Genesis 1 to 14. What we've seen God do is take things apart into a death-like state and then resurrect them. And that's the main thing that's going on here. This path of animal halves represents Abram. And this half of animal, this side of animal paths represents the land. Abram and the land are dead to each other. They should be together, but they're dead to each other. Animals are made of dirt, so they can represent the land. Human beings are like animals, made of dirt also. These animals can represent people. They can represent the land. And God says, 400 years from now, I'm going to move between these two in my glory, and I will resurrect them and seal them together. And 400 years from now, this isn't going to be a land of promise anymore. It's going to be a land that flows with milk and honey. It's going to be a resurrected land. And the people will come out from their 400 years of oppression, and they will be joined to this land. So here in this vision, we see this process of cutting apart, putting back together again in the fire, and death and resurrection. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this, and we're done for the night, is these five animals are the five animals that are used in the Jewish sacrificial system in Leviticus. When Noah got off the ark, Noah offered every clean animal. That's what it says. Not just these. He offered elk and deer and moose and chickens, every clean animal he offered. Now they're reduced to these five. In the rituals in Leviticus, when you read them, you'll find the animals are killed. Their blood is displayed, which is propitiation. But then they're cut apart. And then they're put into the fire and reunited, and they ascend up to God. That happens in all the rituals. Cutting apart, putting into the fire, being put back together again. This is the first time that happens. And one of the things all those rituals mean is, when you sin, you lose the land. And when you bring the sacrifice, God reconnects you to the land. When you sin, you fall back into Egypt. And so you bring the sacrifice and you display the blood just like you did at Passover, splash it against the side of the altar. And then you are put back together and reestablished into the land. We can talk about the sacrifices a bit tomorrow, because I think that's one of the things that we should talk about in explaining the more difficult things in the Bible. But this is where it starts. And I want you to see this darkness, death, cutting apart, putting back together again, waking up more glorious than it was before. That's how God acts. That's what he's doing with us. That's what's going to happen to you when you die. You're going to go to sleep. You're going to wake up more glorious than before. That's what happens to us all the time. So now we can have some questions about